morning. I'm Scott Tenona, a member here at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, and welcome here on this Sunday. I am pleased to have you all here today. If you don't know, if you're a visitor or you haven't been here that long, we are a church or fellowship in transition. We are our minister of 10 years has retired, and come this August, we will be having a new minister come in, and we are moving from part-time to full-time ministry at the same time. This is an exciting time for our group. Today, we have Reverend Sarah Oglesby Dungan coming to us from Topeka, and she is here partly because we like her and partly because she has been a minister there for a year and coming up on a year now, right? And one of the things that she's going to do for us today is talk to us a little bit about what this is like, what this transition is like, and this whole idea of being open to change and evolving. And that is part of what she's doing here today. So welcome. I've got a couple announcements for you. In addition to the announcements that are in your order of service, one thing I want to draw attention to is that there is just a letter to the editor from Katie Kingery Page and our retired minister, our now retired minister, Michael Nelson, in the paper about racial profiling. There's a copy of it out in the narthex, so you know, if you didn't see it in the paper and you don't get the paper, take a look at that. The other thing is that we, after the service, half an hour when our service is done, we will have a workshop about this whole idea of welcoming a new minister and what we can do well and how we can prepare. If you have not already said that you're interested, you are still welcome to join us. There will be food. There should be food enough for the people who have said they'll be there, and there should be a little extra, too, so it'll be all right for you to join in, even if you didn't RSVP. And I think that is about it. We will now light our chalice.
Today's chalice reflection is about appreciating the natural wonders that surround us. It's from Gideon Smith writing in the Scientific American in 1851. Some may regard the cacophony produced by the myriads of 17-year cicadas on a warm day from late May through mid-June as a strident, rasping dissonance. To me, it is a wonderful symphony. Even at full fortissimo, this music of the earth neither vexes the ear nor intrudes on ordinary conversation. It is a rich, pulsating resonance, a wild rhythmic chorus that creates a pervading atmosphere of sound, through which all other sounds float with perfect distinctness. When I heard the last diminishing notes on the 25th of June, I was left with a melancholy reflection. Will I live to hear them again?
Say that maybe that won't. No, that'll make the light come. Won't you join me in reading these words, number 418 in our gray hymnal? Come into the circle of love and justice. Come into the community of mercy, holiness, and health. Come, and you shall know peace and joy. Welcome to Sunday in Manhattan. And won't you stand and join us in singing number 347, Gather the Spirit.
Gather the spirit, harvest the power, our suffering fires, the kindle one flame. Witness the mystery of this song, our trust and fall, but hear all the same. Gather in peace.
we come to that time in our service in which we invite you to share those joys and concerns of a personal nature, those things sitting in your heart that you would like to share and offer up for our mutual celebration, for prayers, warm thoughts, good intentions, whatever you might have to share with us in this healing circle. And I believe you come, the practice here is to come forward to the microphone and share those. No? Do we pass it? Which one do I pass?
I have it.
Oh, you have it. Okay.
Hi. I put out a message on the listserv, but some of you may not have seen it. Our son Eric and his family are coming to town this week, and they will not get here until late tonight, and we'll need to go back next Saturday, so they will not be able to come to a Sunday service. And for that reason, we're having a come and meet and greet, just chat, at our house on Wednesday from 4 until 8 p.m., and any of those of you who wish to see them or look at their beautiful new baby, come on by. The other thing is more of a concern. Ann Cowan, who many of you know, has already had two surgeries, found out on Thursday that her surgery was not successful. She is having a third one tomorrow morning. She will be in the hospital in Junction City probably 10 days. They are going to obviously monitor and watch her closely. I think she'll probably need a lot of help when she gets home. She'll have her cell phone at the hospital, so just keep her in your thoughts and give her a call when you can.
I pulled a tooth.
I'm Jane Pelletier. I imagine many of you know Melody Pooler from especially work with LGBT issues. She put on Facebook this morning that her scleroderma has progressed to such a degree that her lungs are really in terrible condition. And she's on the list for a double lung transplant. She's just getting started on the process, so she asked for good thoughts for her as she goes through this.
Jim Chanteau, and I have a joy and a concern. My joy is that the state of Kansas finally has a budget. My concern is, have you looked at it?
I'm Mickey Ray, and speaking of health, I want to thank the congregation for the Get Well card. I was at Via Christi Villages, and it was like being in a bad movie. So the card was really appreciated.
I've got a simple joy this morning. I finally convinced my chain of command that I'm ready for promotion. I go to my promotion board on the first.
And I would add a word of concern for my husband's friend who died last Saturday and his family at the age of 42. Someone he grew up with and thinks of often. And family of eight, left behind many children and a grandchild. Take a deep breath and let it go and find yourself in this space as we hold all of these joys and concerns, the return of old friends, the welcoming of new children, the concerns of health and surgery, and the gratitude for the support that we receive from this community and others when we need it. For all of those new developments of childhood, each day seems to bring a new one, whether it's lost teeth or a new learned skill or a new place to be visiting. and all of our concerns for the larger community around us, for the state and the folks who make decisions that affect each and all of our lives in different ways, by the way that we fund things or don't, and by the way that we treat each other as we walk in these communities together. For all the celebrations like getting promoted and new challenges, new opportunities that we bring into this space, may we hold all of those together today and every day. And I like to remind folks that between Sundays, we hold you as well. Your joys, your sorrows, your concerns, your celebrations, between Sundays and between when we meet, whether it's next Sunday or next month, or in my case, perhaps even next year, we carry you in our hearts. Welcome to this space. And I will invite children to come join me over here for a story. But it is a story for all ages. How many of you are familiar with John Muth? Anybody? Oh, this will be fun. I'm glad to introduce a new author to you. John Muth is a children's story writer who's also a Buddhist. And he likes to tell stories that I think adults enjoy too, because there's usually kind of a little Buddhist Dharma talk in it that's aimed at children but appropriate for adults. This one's based on a story by someone adults might know, Leo Tolstoy, called The Three Questions. So, let's see if I can make sure that I get pictures to you all as necessary. So there once was a boy named Nikolai who sometimes felt uncertain about the right way to act. "I want to be a good person," he told his friends, "but I don't always know the best way to do that." Nikolai's friends understood, and they wanted to help him. "If only I could find the answers to my three questions," Nikolai continued, "then I would always know what to do." So here he is with his three friends. A dog, a monkey, and a heron. Here are his three questions. Maybe you have them too. What is the best time to do things? Who is the most important one? And what is the right thing to do? Nikolai's friends considered his first question. Then Sonia, the heron, said, "To know the best time to do things, one must plan in advance." Gogol the monkey, who had been rooting through some leaves to find something good to eat, said, "You will know when to do things if you watch and pay close attention." Then Pushkin the dog, who was just dozing off, rolled over and said, "You can't pay attention to everything yourself. You need a pack to keep watch and help you decide when to do things. For example, Gogol, a coconut is about to fall on your head." And I think in our joys and sorrows, we just demonstrated that we need a pack. We do need people to help us out. Nikolai thought for a moment. Then he asked his second question, "Who is the most important one?" "Those who are closest to heaven," said Sonia, circling up into the sky. "Those who know how to heal the sick," said Gogol, stroking his bruised head. "Those who make the rules," said Pushkin. Though they all have their own advice based on their own experience, they're not any of them wrong. Nikolai thought some more, and then he asked the third question, "What is the right thing to do?" "Flying," said Sonia. "Having fun all the time," said Gogol. "Fighting," barked Pushkin right away. Then the boy thought for a long time. He loved his friends, and he knew they were trying their best to help him answer the questions, but their answers didn't seem quite right. Then an idea came to him. "I know," he thought. "I will ask Leo the turtle. He has lived a very long time. Surely he will know the answers I'm looking for." So as in many stories, he goes to the old wise one, who in this case is an old turtle that lives on the hill, to find out the answers to his questions. Nikolai hiked high up into the mountains where the old turtle lived all alone. When Nikolai arrived, he found Leo digging a garden. The turtle was old and digging was hard for him. "I have three questions I came to ask your help," Nikolai said. "When is the best time to do things? Who is the most important one? and what is the right thing to do. Leo listened carefully, but he only smiled, and then he went on with his digging. "You must be tired," Nikolai said at last. "Let me help you." The turtle gave him his shovel and thanked him, and because it was easier for a young boy to dig than it was for an old turtle, Nikolai kept on digging until the rows were finished. But just as he finished, the wind blew wildly and the rain burst from darkened clouds. As they moved toward the cottage for shelter, Nikolai suddenly heard a cry for help. Running down the path, he found a panda whose leg had been injured by a fallen tree. Let me see our panda. Carefully, Nikolai carried her into Leo's house and made a splint for her leg with a stick of bamboo. The storm raged on, banging at the doors and windows. The panda woke up. "Where am I, and where is my child?" So there's the panda getting fixed up by Nikolai. The boy ran out of the cottage and down the path, and the roar of the storm was deafening. Pushing against the howling wind and drenching rain, he ran further into the forest. Then he found the panda's child, cold and shivering on the ground. So there he is running through the forest. The little panda was wet and scared, but alive. Nikolai carried her inside and made her warm and dry. Then he laid her in his mother's arms. Leo smiled when he saw what the boy had done. I bet the grown-ups have figured out who Leo is. The next morning, the sun was warm, birds sang, and all was well with the world. The panda's leg was healing nicely, and she thanked Nikolai for saving her and her baby from the storm. At that moment, Sonia, Gogol, and Pushkin arrived to make sure everyone was all right. Nikolai felt great peace within himself. He had wonderful friends, and he had saved the panda and her child. But he also felt disappointed. He still had not found the answers to his three questions. So he asked Leo one more time. The old turtle looked at the boy. "But your questions have been answered," he said. "They have?" asked the boy. Did you all hear the answers? Let's see what they are. "Yesterday, if you had not stayed to help me dig my garden, you wouldn't have heard the panda's cries for help in the stream. Therefore, the most important time was the time you spent digging the garden. The most important one at that moment was me, and the most important thing to do was to help me in the garden. Later, when you found the injured panda, the most important time was the time you spent mending her leg and saving her child. The most important ones were the panda and her child. And the most important thing was to take care of them and make them safe. Remember that there is only one important time, and that time is now. The most important one is always the one you are with. And the most important thing to do is good for the one who is standing at your side. For these, my dear boy, are the answers to what is most important in this world. That is why we are here." So I hope that you will have both great friends, like Leo's friends and Nikolai's friends, and I hope that you will always have folks who will stand with you and be with you in the moment. And now we're going to sing it to your class.
On the Ridge by Mark Nepo. We can grow by simply listening, the way the tree on that ridge listens its branches to the sky, the way blood listens its flow to the sight of a wound, the way you listen like a basin when my head, so full of grief, can't look you in the eye. We can listen our way out of howling, the way the heart can soften the wolf we keep inside. We can last by listening deeply, the way roots listen for the next inch of earth, the way the old turtle listens, all he hears into the pattern of his shell.
Once a month, this fellowship joins up with a charity or an organization outside of us, but usually within the community, and we take our collections and we give it to this other cause. Today, that organization is Shepherd's Crossing, and Beverly Olson will come here to tell you a little bit about what your generous contributions will do. Let me remind you that anything you do give away in the offering that's not labeled to go to the church will all be going to Shepherd's Crossing.
Thank you, Scott, and good morning to all of you. It's wonderful to see the green grass, the produce from all this rain we've been having. It's sometimes wonderful because we see the green stuff growing, but then we see the weeds grow too. But that's all a part of our nature, isn't it? So, yes, Shepherd's Crossing is actually a nonprofit program that helps people who are in a financial emergency with rent, utilities, or prescriptions. And I thought I'd just give you a couple of notes about what happened last year. And I know we're already in the middle of the month, or the middle of the year, but in 2014, we actually sent out over $220,000 to help pay for rent, utility bills, or for prescriptions. Now, if you figure that out and use your mathematical brain a little bit, we actually helped almost 900 families with that. So you can kind of figure that there was an average of about 150, 60, 70, depending on the situation and case. Betty helps us in our counseling sessions, so she knows that oftentimes she'd love to give $300, $400, $500, $600 to help someone because they're really in a special need at that point. Where others, we've figured out that maybe they're not being so wise with their monies. And so we think, like, maybe we should only help them with about $50 because they need to learn to budget their income a little bit better. So it's that kind of mindset that keeps us on our toes, of course. And we've been blessed with some fantastic volunteers who come in and counsel with our people. We actually go through a little budget session with them. It's only about a half hour long, so it's nothing great and grand. But we do try to help them, and I like to use the word tweak, their budget by maybe cutting down on this or maybe seeing if they could have a few more hours to work or maybe get a second part-time job. But the problem arises most often when we have a single parent. And I'm reminded of one recently where this single parent became a single parent because her boyfriend, the father of her two children, was not making the best decisions and he became incarcerated. Well, therefore, there's no extra money coming into the doors. And she's got children, one under the age of school. So she has to be home during the day to take care of the child that's at home. And then, of course, in the evenings to take care of both of them after the other one comes home from school. So what do you do in a predicament like that? If you don't have the man around to have income, she's got to care for her child. So there's a couple of solutions, though, we like to offer. And one is to partner with a friend, a girlfriend who has children. And maybe during a time that this young lady could go and get a part-time job, a neighbor could be watching her little one. And then she could alternate that. And maybe at nighttime, her neighbor could have an evening job. And then this lady could help watch her children during that time. And we've actually had a couple of scenarios where that has come about. So those are just a few of the simple ideas that we come up with sometimes. Things such as if you've got cable coming into your house, we know how expensive that can be. If you're on a limited budget of $400 or $500 a month, cable probably isn't something you can afford. What a shame. But there's other things that you can do. And we have an intern who actually produces a calendar of free things that families can do with their children. Now, as we were raising our little ones, did we come up with free things that we could do with our kids? Can you go to the park? Can you go to the splash park? That's totally free. You can walk around at the mall. There's all kinds of sites and things down there. The library is full of stuff to go and bring children to. Most awesome. So we try and give them all those different ideas. We also have sheets of probably 25 different resources that they can go to on the internet to find a job. I mean, we've got all the local ones besides the internet ones. So the best we can do is just give them some ideas. And bless you all for helping in this community. I know you're not just involved with your congregation here. You're involved in other community action civic groups too. And all those things, all those activities that you participate in help our community become what a good thing it is to be here. So thank you so much. And if you have questions, I'll be back there in the front, and I'll be glad to answer those. And I actually have some of our simple brochures. If you as a congregation or you in another group would like to share some of this information to others, we're most happy to do a little talk to them too and give them some highlights on what's been going on in our community. Thank you so much for your time.
A Ritual to Read to Each Other by William Stafford. If you don't know the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are, a pattern that others made may prevail in the world, and following the wrong God home, we may miss our star. For there is many a small betrayal in the mind, a shrug that lets the fragile secrets break, sending with shouts the horrible errors of childhood storming out to play through the broken dike. And as elephants parade holding each elephant's tail, but if one wanders, the circus won't find the park. I call it cruel and maybe the root of all cruelty to know that what occurs, to know what occurs, but not recognize the fact. And so I appeal to a voice, to something shadowy, a remote, important region in all who talk. Though we fool each other, we should consider, lest the parade of our mutual life gets lost in the dark. For it is important that awake people be awake, or a breaking line may discourage them back to sleep. The signals we give, yes or no, or maybe, should be clear. The darkness around us is deep.
Thank you.
So Unitarian Universalism is a covenantal faith community. Sometimes we try to explain this by saying that we are non-creedal, but that doesn't really tell us what a covenant is or why we engage in covenant making. And I think it's important here to see the difference between transactional and relational interactions. In transactional interactions, when our business is done, there is nothing more. We can exist as individuals pursuing our own needs, and when those are met, we just move on, like buying a car. In covenantal relational interactions, we agree to be in relationship in an ongoing way. And we make some promises about who we will be in relation to one another. In his article for the UU World, Fred Muir talks about the shift from a culture of I church, where individualism has reigned in ways that have become deleterious, to the dawning of an understanding of communalism and beloved community. He points to what he calls the trinity of UU errors. And these are allowing ourselves to be stymied by a pervasive, disturbing, and disruptive commitment to individualism that misguides our ability to engage the changing times. In other words, we can't agree on what we will do together, and we allow some folks, to dominate the stage while nothing gets done. A second one of these trinity of errors is that we might cling to a belief in UU exceptionalism that is often insulting to others and undermines what our good news actually is. And the third one is when we refuse to acknowledge and treat our allergy to authority and power, which compromises a more healthy future. In other words, we fail to find a place for humility. Ironically, in our tradition and past, we find many examples of prophetic voices that have pointed us in the direction of covenant and community. In Dedham, Massachusetts, in 1637, our religious ancestors proclaimed that they would covenant to walk together in the spirit of love, humbly and with a teachable heart. In covenant, we recognize that we will make mistakes and fail one another over and over again. And we promise to keep coming back to the table, to come back with our intention and promise about who we will be together. And here at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, as in many faith communities, you likely have several levels of covenant in operation at any given time. You may even have specific covenants with a minister or a director of religious education about how they will serve your community. And as Reverend Nelson leaves his covenant of service with you, you will begin a new covenant soon with a new minister. And you may also covenant to care for one another, as we heard about during Joys and Sorrows. You might even have a caring committee designed to do just that work. But you also do this in all of those numerous small ways, like setting up this space for Sunday service, making coffee, cleaning up, organizing activities that you'll do together, volunteering in a religious education classroom, sharing stories, greeting new people, and even when you sit next to one another for service. You do this when you commit to serve on committees, and when you share a check-in for a meeting, and when you extend your relationships beyond Sunday. You show up to grow yourselves and to offer a place for one another that sustains and affirms our lives. You may also work to repair broken relationships and offer forgiveness. And you may work to find healing for yourselves and for each other. But we can't only be concerned with our own growth and our relationships with each other. Our covenant also reaches beyond our individual congregations, beyond even Unitarian Universalism, and into the world around us, and asks us to make promises about how we will work together for change, how we will collaborate with other people and organizations, just as we did passing the offertory. This larger covenant, which begins with the principles and purposes that we hope to live in this world, asks us to make commitments to move beyond individualism and into communalism, into interdependence. Reverend Galen Gingrich, in his book God Revised, says it this way. The defining commitment that members of a religious community make to each other arises from their calling or their covenantal duty to bear witness to each other's lives, the lives they now lead and the lives they hope to lead in the future, and the world they now occupy as well as the world they hope to occupy in the future. Reverend Grace Simon says this and agrees that you use agree to be in relationship rather than to share doctrinal agreements. And it turns out that this is a lot more complex and difficult than the road would be otherwise. She says that we need to be in agreement about the equality and worth of each person and the ways we treat each other. We also need an agreement about the importance of expanding our knowledge and understanding and the connections between and among us humans and all the other creatures and features of the earth. This covenant may begin with the people we find ourselves sitting next to today and every day, but it implies a commitment to all of the world around us, humans and the environment in which we coexist. Fred Muir writes this urgently in his article, The End of iChurch. The vision of a deep covenantal community life, as it is already named in our principles, is bold. Many of us proudly recite our principles and purposes. We testify, we march, we talk with newcomers. What is vital is committing to this expression of our faith not as I church, not from the narrow goal of individualism, but the promise of covenant and beloved community. The Unitarian Universalist story of the 21st century begins not only with our historical commitment to social justice outreach, but also with congregational justice inreach. It begins with your congregation. Your congregation, this congregation, is the beloved community. It begins right here, in the ways we live out our promises to one another and to the community that surrounds us, to the people we know and the people we know only about. And it can even begin in how you welcome a new minister, as well as how you welcome new members and create relationships that exhibit the values you hope to take beyond these walls. In January last year, I traveled from northern Colorado, where I used to live, to Albuquerque, New Mexico, to be part of a Unitarian Universalist conference and training opportunity where we explored the idea of beloved community. We explored it as an idea, a practice, and an intention, as a possibility for our congregations, our communities, and even for the wider world. Reverend Deb Holder, one of our speakers, created a framework for us around this idea, which she called the Fourth Great Awakening, and which she says is characterized right now by an insistence on connection, experimentation, and creativity, spiritual deepening, and developing practices that ground us in our experiences and knowing. This is a place of collaboration where we learn from moving from merely seeking to practicing and creating learning communities that are open and willing to risk change in order to transform. In such a learning community, we are willing to be coached, to have, in the words of our forebears in Dedham, Massachusetts, teachable hearts, and to sit with not knowing. We're willing to let go of our individual certainties in order to make room for new ways of being together and moving together. In inviting a new minister into your midst, you will be inviting the possibility of learning new ways from a new person, inviting new expertise, experiences, and knowledge, as well as new ways of knowing and understanding or seeing the world. In seeking to create beloved community, we are also willing to acknowledge when we've hurt one another or have fallen short in our promises. We move to restore integrity and relationship, relinquishing the need to be right or wrong in order to stay in relationship. Relinquishing the need to be right or wrong just to stay in relationship. We're willing to see ourselves as a work in progress and as interdependent partners working alongside one another. And as poet Marge Piercy says in her poem, To Have Without Holding, learning to love differently is hard. Love with the hands wide open, love with the doors banging on their hinges, the cupboard unlocked, the wind roaring and whimpering in the rooms, rustling the sheets and snapping the blinds that thwack like rubber bands in an open palm. This is what we do when we are in beloved community, learning to love differently, to have and not to hold. When we leave the cupboard unlocked and allow the wind to fill the open spaces, we risk being blown over, and yet we allow something or someone to enter that could not have entered before. This is what it allows us to experience what Parker Palmer refers to as that grounded place in each of us where we can overcome fear, rediscover that we are members of one another, and embrace the conflicts that threaten democracy as openings to new life for us and for our nation and for our congregations. Or as Clarence Skinner says, beloved community is the comradeship of those who forget themselves and their passion to find the common life where the good of all is the quest of each. I love that. Where the good of all is the quest of each. Well, we wouldn't give to have more leaders who share that vision. Beloved community has the quality of fierce love, snapping the blinds that thwack like rubber bands in an open palm. Or as Martin Luther King Jr. described it, love, beloved community, embodies a radical redefinition of relationships that imagines and creates a type of love that can transform opponents into friends. Are you willing to step into this journey? Amen. You are already on the threshold, and yet you may still be wondering, where will we find this revolution? Hopefully, you'll find it right here, and you are finding it right here, in this congregation and other congregations like it. At our training, Reverend Holder said that she shared these bold assertions, which call us to embrace the possibility of a church that has the purpose to grow our capacity to love the divine, ourselves, and each other, and calls us to healing work that addresses lovelessness and injustice, beginning in our congregations and working out. Reverend Holder echoes the words of Richard Rohr, who said that pain that is not transformed is transmitted. Pain that is not transformed is transmitted, whether it's here in this room or out in your community. She invites us to justice work made sustainable through spiritual practice and shared community, and to be willing to see ourselves as a religious community with a unique contribution to make to the justice movement. To invite a new minister to work with you in all of these endeavors, to transform pain and loss into joy and possibility, to bring connection and meaning to your lives and the lives you hope to touch, to shape yourselves and your community into instruments of healing and justice. This will require a commitment to staying present, listening, to staying in covenant with each other and with your new minister. The conclusion we find is that we're already in the midst of a paradigm shift that has so powerfully reframed justice work and meaningful congregational life as the tasks of beloved community, which sees us not as political champions in a boxing match or philosophical warriors, but as an integral whole in which right relationship is more important than being right. Right relationship is more important than being right. In this frame, Reverend Holder explains that instead of seeing issues as problems to be solved, we might instead see issues as a way of life to be transformed. Instead of being reactive or motivated by fear and anger, We might move into being proactive and motivated by hope and creativity. In this way, we enter into justice-making and sacred circles of healing, also known as congregations, because all of us are made whole and find healing in this paradigm. This paradigm is life-sustaining and enhancing for all of us. So what are the tools of Beloved Community? While we were there, we explored compassionate communication and intercultural competency, as well as song, worship, playing together as practices we might engage in order to rediscover right relationship and transform our painful realities. This work begins with self-awareness and a willingness to try out new perspectives, to ask questions, and to be vulnerable. It acknowledges the universal needs that we each have and suspends judgment about the strategies and tools we use to get those needs met. We find empathy and experience difference with a new lens and a new openness. As Marge Piercy says, she notices it this way: I can't do it. You say it's killing me, but you thrive. You glow on the street like a neon raspberry. You float and sail, a helium balloon, bright bachelor's button blue, bobbing on the cold and hot winds of our breath. When we open, when we learn to love differently, we may find ourselves made new, alive with energy and new possibilities. What is challenging, even threatening, eventually becomes life-giving and enlightening. This is the rhythm of our unbound loving that Piercy describes. The Beloved Community is full of call and response. We seek to find what we don't know, and we don't know that we don't know, so that we might live into this place of uncertainty and not knowing long enough to experience a transformation where we can experience a new context and a new knowing that is not just mine, and that is not just yours, that is not just your new minister's, and not just yours, but is somehow all of ours. Covenant is about relationship, about spirit, about love, and the interdependent web of which we are all a part and which we reference so frequently. It begins right here as we Unitarian Universalists meet each Sunday. In our congregations, we offer each other more immediate gifts: a kind greeting, a passionate discussion, washing dishes, refreshments and laughter, new weeks with meetings and planning and sharing a vision, funds pledged for all of this work. We live our covenant in so many ways. We bring it to life in each of these actions. And as Martin Buber says, we are definitely promise-making, promise-keeping, promise-breaking, and promise-renewing beings. Covenant does not imply perfection, but rather a commitment to keep coming back to the table. And it also implies that we will keep an open table, and we will travel to other tables, maybe even to Topeka. It implies that we will look for ways to learn together, to work together, and to seek out kindred spirits whose values and work may complement our own. So as we close this time together and move into a time of workshop and more discussion, let us stand and sing together, one of the many ways that we express ourselves as a community. I invite you to hymn number 1017, Building a New World. It's a little jazzy, so the rhythms are a little bit different. It's in your teal hymnal. I'll have you know that Eric Banner loves this hymn. You can tell him you sing it. He'll be very impressed with you.
New way. our world.